Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 24th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about astronomy with us. So if you have a question about the planets or the galaxies or the universe or black holes, whatever, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Just don't ask Bob to recite pi for the whole show, because I don't want to hear it. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. The number again, though, is 800-348-2551. Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers today for twice the fun. It's Bob Berman, who is the author of, I think, 12 or 13 books. He's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for these two, give us a call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org for the emails, and the number 800-348-2551. Valerie Rapson, welcome back.
Thank you.
Are you all right? It's getting to be the end of the semester.
I'm tired, and I think every professor would agree that this is like the most tiring part of the year. The last couple of weeks, you know, getting ready for finals, helping the students with all their projects. So it's exhausting, but we've almost made it.
Let me ask you a question. Now, without giving names, any Fs on the horizon?
Hopefully not.
No?
No. My goal is to lift anybody towards the bottom up, you know, help them, give them that last push that they need. I don't want to see anybody fail.
Well, we don't want to see anybody fail, but there may be some underachievers there. You never know, right?
They all have potential. That's my idea.
Okay. I like it. Bob Berman, what's up with you, sir?
Well, it's just great to be back from all the trips so far, and I have just loving to be in the Hudson Valley during this marvelous time of year, and don't have to go anywhere else until November when we take a group to the Atacama Desert.
Oh, I see. Okay, that'll be fun. What time of year are you talking about in the Hudson Valley? Tick season? What do we
Tick
mean?
Tick season, yes. Did you hear that there's a pharmaceutical company and it's final testing for a Lyme disease vaccine?
No, I did not.
That's very close to fruition.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. Well, let's see. Things are going on in the heavens. I saw a news item. It was all over the place last week. A team of astronomers announced on April 16th that in the process of studying a planet around another star, they have found evidence, allegedly the strongest evidence yet, for a gaseous signature for possible life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are we talking about here?
There's been so much drama over this article, but it's been really fascinating to read. So long story short, there's this exoplanet. It's K218b.
Far away.
A couple hundred light years away, I think. So relatively close compared to some of them. But what's interesting is that there are earlier articles that speculated this would be a Hyacine world, which basically means a larger than Earth rocky planet with a liquid water surface and a hydrogen atmosphere.
And this is in the Goldilocks zone around its star, which is a red dwarf, right?
Right, exactly. So the star is smaller. It's in the Goldilocks zone. And there's been a couple articles debating, is this actually a super Earth with a liquid water ocean, or is it like a mini Neptune, a small gas giant? And we don't know for sure. The latest articles are really leaning towards mini Neptune, but it's difficult to know. So if this planet really is a rocky planet, the astronomers recently found, using James Webb, a signature of potentially dimethyl sulfide, which is an element that's produced by like algae and plankton on Earth. So having this element in the atmosphere of the planet might suggest that there is, you know, active life in a liquid water ocean underneath.
Would it have to be liquid water? In other words, could it still be a Neptune-like planet and still have some microbial life?
Well, it's unlikely. With this element on Earth, we only see it, you know, kind of in this type of biological process. You have to have water. But we've also discovered this element in comets. We've seen it in other galaxies. And, you know, that probably doesn't have an origin of living creatures. There's probably some chemical process creating this. So we don't fully understand how objects in outer space have this element. But since there are other potential signatures that tell us that this might have an ocean, the scientists are leaning towards more the life potential for this element creation.
Well, to follow up on that, wasn't there a whiff of this chemical on Venus?
That was phosphine.
Ah.
Yeah, yeah.
Also a potential signature, but not necessarily so.
Right. Phosphine can be created by living creatures and many chemical things, but the idea was that phosphine is more of a fragile element, so it wouldn't survive in the Venusian atmosphere too long. So the fact that we saw it would suggest that there's something like actively creating it all the time there. But it's really difficult with these materials because the signatures are not blatant. When you look at a spectrum, it's not like there's a huge spike and you can definitely point to it and say, yes, that is the only thing that can create that spike.
Right.
These are teeny tiny little wiggles that, you know, many elements could possibly fit the model. And while this is a relatively strong potential, there's still other options that need to be explored.
And from what I'm reading, scientists are still, there's still a hefty amount of skepticism about this. But still, to me, it's amazing if this thing's hundreds of light years away and the web can, you know, separate out some of these gases from so far away. Bob, you've been an astronomer since what? Copernicus, right? Doesn't this blow your mind, the technology now at our fingertips?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just, it's fabulous. And we've known for a long time that if we're going to find life existing on the surface of a planet, this is how we're going to do it. We're going to see a change in the atmosphere because life changes its environment. That's how the Viking lander in 1976 looked for life on Mars. They figured that if there's life, it's going to change its environment. So the lander took a little bit of Martian soil, added a kind of a chicken soup, what they thought life might like, and then measured the atmosphere around it to see if it radioactively tagged it, by the way, and then saw if it changed. And it did.
Yeah.
So it did find evidence for life on Mars, and then it still remains a kind of puzzling in possibility, although it was generally dismissed by most astronomers as just some strange unknown chemistry.
But interesting. But one of the scientists, and I don't know the guy's name, who was on that program, still sticks to this and is really annoyed that everybody has poo-pooed that evidence.
Right, and he's quite right because it was a positive result. They set up an experiment. If they got that result, that would have been considered positive. They did get that result, and yet scientists, who tend to be skeptics anyway, which is good, generally said, nah, probably not. But come on, how much more do you want than a positive result from the experiment that was set up to do just that?
Right, yeah. And I think you guys really hit on the two key pieces is one that, you know, now we have the technology where we can really start to dig in and maybe find these biosignatures and proof of life. But also what you said, Bob, is hard. Right? It's not easy. There isn't one specific thing we can look for and say, if we find this, we definitely know that there's aliens on this planet. It's going to take multiple detections by different telescopes of a variety of things that when you put it all together, the only answer can be life on that planet.
Speaking of technology, and we'll go back a little ways, Valerie, you told me, and by the way, we're talking astronomy today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. You told me today a very famous telescope is celebrating a birthday.
Yes, happy birthday, Hubble. 35th anniversary from the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope.
Amazing.
I know.
And then how long did it take for them to fix the flaw?
about 3 years or so before it got fixed, because they had to, you know, they had to notice the flaw, which that was pretty immediate. Then they had to come up with a game plan to fix it, and then they had to build it and launch and get up there. So it was a really long and expensive process.
It was a horrible thing for Perk and Elmer, who had built the mirror. They're out of Danbury, and they were known to be the best optical firm in the world. The equivalent of three quarters of a century ago, Alvin Clark was making the best telescopes. Now it was Perk and Elmer. They had the contract, and they created the mirror with spherical aberration. It was only 1/50th of a human hair off, but that was enough. Spherical aberration is something that I would do that I would screw up by if I were building a telescope mirror. But they're not supposed to. And once it's in orbit, it's not as easy to fix as something that an amateur would do if they messed up the mirror.
Nowadays, you could fix that with digital software, DSP, right? And well, compensate for that?
Well, they did eventually compensate for it by losing one of their instruments. They had to take it out because there wasn't room for it, and then putting in the equivalent of a contact lens. To readjust the focus. And when you saw the images, if you look it up, the first image was of Galaxy M100, and it was a blurry mess. And it made all of us laugh and cry at the same time, like, come on, how is this possible?
Right.
And then when you look at the fixed-up image of M100, we go, oh, wow. You know, so it was a triumph of ingenuity along with a horrible blunder.
It's hard to believe that, you know, the only telescope that we could go up in space and fix is the one that we needed to do that with. Right?
So
like,
far.
I just can't get over that. You know, if it was James Webb or Chandra, or, you know, any one of the others that we launched up there just for good, you know, that's it. We're not going to fix them, even if they are broken. But the one that we could desperately needed it.
And it's still in operation?
Yeah, it's still in operation. It's
when
doing
will it
really
be
good.
Decommissioned, as it were?
So they're hoping to get another 10 years or so out of it. It's down to two gyroscopes, and they're only operating one at a time to try and save it so that we can accurately point it and keep it going. But so far, the instruments, I think there's five cameras, spectrographs, whatever on there still, and they all seem to be operating fairly well. You know, it's got solar power, so we don't have to worry about battery issues or anything. So they're hoping another 10 years, and the real issue is going to be at the end of that 10-year period, the drag that Hubble is experiencing is going to start to weigh on it, and it's going to sink in the atmosphere. So we either have to go up and boost it, which is what we did every time we did a service mission, or we have to, you know, maneuver it down to the ground.
So it'll burn up at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it shouldn't be dismissed. The 94-inch mirror, you know, people say, well, you know, James Webb is so much bigger, but 94-inch telescope, that's not small change. That's not chopped liver.
Let's take a break here. It's astronomy, and we'll get to your calls and emails in a moment. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. Marquees, Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551. Ray Graff with you. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And before we hit the phones, Al writes in, is it permissible or acceptable for professional and academic astronomers to be open-minded and non-derisively curious about UAWs, so-called aliens on Earth, and so on? What do you think are the most likely possibilities? And that's from Al.
You're looking at me.
Well, so. You were saying before the show, we really haven't had many calls about UFOs and aliens in a while. And
that's right.
You go. You get your wish.
So that just shows that by itself it should be looked at, that you think of something that you've not thought of in a long time, and then it happens. Why does that happen?
You're evading the question, sir.
Aliens on Earth.
Is it acceptable to be open-minded about it in the scientific circle?
I don't think it's acceptable because I think, first of all, it's outside the realm of science. There's no way. You know, we deal with observation and experiment. There's an old-fashioned idea, which is that you can say anything, and we keep hearing ideas like the multiverse, for example. But if you can't prove it, if there's no experiment or way that you can demonstrate its reality, then that's just an idea.
I object.
So this is one of those. So because it's no more than a thought, that some of us seeming humans are actually aliens, and they, I guess, presumably know that they're aliens. We're not talking about, I came back when I got my 23andMe report as something like 4% Neanderthal.
I believe it.
I knew I was setting myself up for trouble with that one. Why can't I edit my comments? So in this case, you know it. The aliens would presumably know they're aliens and they're here on some sort of odd mission. But I guess the questioner is talking about people who were here who were aliens and didn't even know.
No, I think this person just wants to know. I think Al just wants to know, is it permissible today for a scientist to openly say, well, I have an open mind on this? Clearly you do not.
No,
however, let me tell you this. You're the guy who says, oh, the universe is alive. Okay, now we don't have 4 hours, but prove that to me in 12 seconds before I hand it over to Valerie.
That's not an original thought either. A century ago, especially Werner Heisenberg and the rest of his quantum buddies all came away believing that consciousness is fundamentally the groundwork of the universe, that the universe revolves around a conscious single essence, and that's what it is. So from consciousness, you get life. I mean, it implies life anyway. It implies a living, eternal, conscious universe. And that's a growing idea. And by the way, since the 2022 Nobel Prize in Physics supported John Bell's work, which supports that to an extent, and I have a friend who's a head of an observatory out in Arizona who told me that he's seeing in the literature more and more consciousness arising in the actual literature. Mm-hmm. This has become a legitimate topic, but I think that's a long cry from aliens among us. Really.
Well, now let me read the exact question again to Valerie and see what Valerie says. The number is 800-348-2551. Kathy and Seward, you'll be first. Al says, is it permissible or acceptable for professional and academic astronomers to be open-minded and non-derisively curious about UAWs? I think he means UAPs. UAW, I mean, we know the United Auto Workers are alive. What do you think are the most likely possibilities? And that's from Al. Valerie.
So I think we should always be open to ideas, but We have to be careful about, you know, which solution we jump to first when something happens, right? You know, I think Bob is saying we don't want to blame every strange thing that we can't explain on aliens, but I think it's fine to always have that as a last resort. We should consider it if we can't explain it otherwise. So I like the idea of being open-minded, but we also have to be realistic about what should we check first and how should we go through this process to prove it, because we need evidence before we can truly believe that there are other creatures amongst us.
Of course, and proof being the key thing. But if you're not going around leaping to logical conclusions and your mind is open, that should not be, you should not be derided for that. And frankly, what the Royal Meteorological Society of France or whatever it was that said, no, meteorites cannot be, rocks cannot come from the sky. This was this is what they said. And they all agreed this cannot happen. Stones cannot fall from the sky until someone brought them a stone.
Well, your examples could be endless. Lord Kelvin, late in the 19th century, said that heavier than air flying machines were impossible. He said that X-rays were a hoax, that X-rays couldn't possibly exist. I mean, it's endless the number of people who are skeptical about things that actually do exist. But if there's aliens among us, wouldn't their DNA be different in all the testing and genetic testing? Would it really be, if it was identical to Homo sapiens DNA, then in what sense are they aliens?
I think you're jumping to conclusions that the aliens are here. What Al's saying is, well, we're seeing weird things. Shouldn't we be open-minded about it?
No, he said amongst us, right?
Well, you know, UAPs or UAWs,
right,
as he said. Listen, let's go to the phones. This is an argument that no one can win except me. Kathy in Seward, you're on.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
You bet.
And, you know, you've been very technical, so this is going to be easy. When I look out one of my windows towards the west and slightly north, there's a very bright, I mean, it looks like a star, but
Jupiter.
I don't think it blinks. What is it, Jupiter?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Wow, you waited 20 minutes for that one. All right.
We'll even tell you the time.
I sure did, but it's well
worth
it.
We'll tell you the time. We'll even tell you the time that you've been seeing it. You've been seeing it the first few hours after nightfall.
Yeah. You know, like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, well, that's the answer. Well, thank you very much for the call, Kathy. Thanks for hanging in there. This email, and I just lost it. I'm so sorry. I read this stuff on my phone and my eyesight, even with my glasses.
Well, while you look, I'll mention we've got, you know, both Jupiter and Mars in the sky right now. And then, you know, there's that thing going around about the smiley face that we're all supposed to see tomorrow night.
Ridiculous.
Have you seen this?
What smiley face?
So the moon is going to be in a crescent phase in the early morning hours tomorrow and Saturday.
Yeah.
And I think it's Saturn and Venus are going to be relatively near the moon. And all the pictures you see are like showing Saturn and Venus as little dots that look like eyes right above a little smiley face shaped moon.
Isn't that cute?
It is cute. But in reality, they're going to be like very largely spaced in the sky.
Yeah.
So like you could imagine maybe drawing a triangle to make them. But it's not going to be this planetary smiley face that everyone's hoping for.
Plus, this crescent won't be a smile. It'll be on its side.
Yeah.
So, but this just Valerie is just emphasizing, which I'm glad she's doing, is that the web is just absolutely full of astronomical nonsense over and over and over again. So if you see something that looks intriguing, go to a real source. Go to an astronomy magazine of some sort or get a real source of information.
Because I'm feeling contrarian today, let me take the opposite side of this. Scientists, is it not a good thing when whatever reason gets people to look up at the heavens at night? Isn't that ultimately a good thing?
I think only the tiniest fraction look up. I think they see this on the web. A smiley face tomorrow morning. How many are going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and look eastward or drive to where they have a clear horizon, which is what they need in the east in order to see this thing? How many are really going to do that? What they're going to do is say, oh, there's going to be a smiley face. They're just going to believe it. And if we don't care about what's real and what isn't real, which I guess a lot of people don't, then we could leave it alone. But those of us who are into science and actually believe in science and believe in facts, there's enough of it in politics and in other areas of our society, at least with science and with astronomy. Let's at least keep this real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like to see people excited about space. You know, I like when they promote meteor showers and planets in the sky, but we do have to try and keep it maybe a little more realistic. You know, they're always looking for the big headline or the picture that's going to get someone to click on the article. But sometimes I look at these and I just sigh. And then, you know, I get texts from all my friends of when can I see the smiley face? And I'm like, then I have to be the one to disappoint them. Right. I think it puts scientists sometimes in this, like, you know, bad light because we're always getting on the news saying, well, no, actually, it's not as cool as you think. And,
oh, boy.
But, you know,
and then we sound like Debbie Downer.
Yeah, you know what? That's exactly what I was going to call you. And I was going to say, Valerie, I'm disappointed.
Usually, you're
the positive one.
I try and find that healthy balance because I love outreach and I like people getting excited, but there's going to be no smiley
face. The nature of clickbait is to say something that sounds like it's very exciting coming up. So I understand the process that goes on.
Right.
For example, some of them are talking about don't miss the Lyrid meteor shower, the next meteor shower that's coming up. But there's many, many meteor showers that only throw a few extra shooting stars per hour in the sky. And it means that instead of the 6 per hour that you'd see any night if you're away from the lights of a city, especially after midnight, you can count on 6 an hour. So some of these will raise it to 9 an hour.
Okay.
And you're not going to notice the difference. There are several genuine meteor showers. So the point is, never mind.
So just don't bother to look up in the sky, everybody. Boys and girls, just cut it out. Now, you've heard it from the scientists. Just don't even bother. This email from Andre in Croton-on-Hudson. With all the talk about possibilities of meteorites hitting the Earth or Moon, how big of a hit could possibly slightly dislodge or shift the Moon's orbit around the Earth? If so, what would be the impact to life on Earth with a minimal or maximal shift of the Moon's orbit?
Ooh.
Believe it or not, these are things I worry about often.
That'd be a pretty big hit, you know?
Yeah, like, the moon weighs 88 times less than Earth.
Yeah.
88 times less, but it's still a substantial body. Previous objects that have hit the moon, and you can see them with any small telescope because those are the craters. And none of them, going by the record, because we have records of how long the moon was going back by several means, have changed the orbit of the moon. So you're talking about a cement truck hitting a fly on the windshield. You're not going to change its path, but you can make a nice crater on it.
Okay, fair enough. So the moon will not come crashing down, or there will not be debris hurled our way.
Highly unlikely.
Okay,
I think we'll be okay.
All right, we've had debris. We actually have over a dozen meteorites in hand that are lunar meteorites. Where an object hit the moon, blasted pieces into space, and a few of them found their way to Earth.
That is very cool. All right, let's go back to our phone lines, and we'll go to Hancock, Massachusetts. Joseph, you're on.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, my question is, many of us grew up with the elementary school picture of the solar system with the sun in the middle, in the classroom, a poster like 3 foot by 3 foot with the planets nicely in circles. I saw a video recently that purported to show the sun in motion and the planets going around it, but because the sun is in motion, it's pulling them, they don't go around like it's portrayed in a poster. They're sort of being drawn behind the sun slightly in a spiral motion. Yeah. Could you comment on the accuracy of that video?
The problem with that video is it tends to show all the planets moving at the same speed. So the corkscrews going around the Earth, yes, they're larger and they're smaller. So they're trying to depict the more distant planets and the closer planets all doing corkscrews as the sun moves. What they're failing to do is show the huge variation in speeds. Mercury goes around the sun in just 88 days. Pluto takes 248 years. Neptune, 165 years. Just compare that, 88 days and 165 years for the major planets, and just think of how that video should have been done. Mercury should have been shown whipping rapidly around it, whereas you wouldn't even see the corkscrew changing of Neptune if it were done accurately. But okay, there we are being Debbie Downers again.
Yeah.
No, the general idea is correct, though, because the sun is moving around the galaxy. So you want to think of the planets orbiting the sun while the sun is orbiting the galaxy. And even the sun is orbiting a little imaginary spot in space. So it's not even sitting still with the planets going around it. So it's much more complicated than our posters show, for sure.
Valerie said a fascinating thing just then. That we always, and the caller said, the planet's going around the sun. But because every planet and the sun balance around their place called a barycenter, where their gravity's exactly balanced like a seesaw, they go around their fulcrum point of the seesaw, so that in the case of very massive Jupiter, which is the most massive planet, it actually orbits a spot outside the sun's surface, and the sun makes a little wiggle. Once every 11.86 years, which is Jupiter's period of revolution around the sun. And so Jupiter and the sun are both making this orbit around a spot that's not even within the sun.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said something, Valerie, that I have not heard, that the sun is also moving around a spot. What's the spot?
Well, that's what Bob was just talking about, that center of mass between Jupiter and the sun.
But the sun is moving around that?
Yeah. Yeah.
The sun, I think you're thinking about the center of the galaxy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's
so I'm confused.
At 144 miles per second, the sun is moving around the center of the galaxy, taking us all with it.
Mm-hmm. And everything is moving at the same speed?
Yeah. I mean, all the planets have to. Otherwise, we'd be left behind.
No. I mean, all the other stars?
No, it depends on their distance from the center. Like, right near the center of the galaxy, we have a 4 million mass black hole. And stars very close to that are whipping around it faster because the gravity is so strong. But in our neighborhood, our neighbor stars are all going at about the same speed because we keep seeing them.
Yeah. All right, this email from Mark, who wanted to talk a little about the Hubble. Mark writes, I recently viewed a program on the National Geographic Channel on demand named Hubble's Cosmic Journey. It's an excellent review of the mirror problem and the eventual fix. The mirror manufacturer complained that the final testing had been scrapped prematurely to launch the telescope. The whole mess could probably have been avoided.
Yes, 100%. We didn't test it thoroughly enough. Otherwise, we would have caught it beforehand. And, you know, that just goes to show that you should always budget for a little extra testing if you're going to do something that's, you know, as big as important as the Hubble Space Telescope.
Well, why would you not do that if you spent all that money on that?
Yes. Now, normally you use something called a null corrector to do the testing. And there were two types. There was a reflective null corrector and a refractive null corrector. The newer one was the one that they did not use. They used the older one, and it showed that the mirror shape was correct. And they said, okay. Mm. And so they could have done that extra bit of testing. You know what? I'm saying it wrong. They used that showed that it was a little off, and they said it must be wrong.
Oh.
No, that must be wrong.
Interesting.
So,
okay.
They screwed up. That was Perkin Elmer out of Danbury, Connecticut.
That, you know, it goes to show that if something is going to possibly go wrong, it will go wrong.
Right, right.
What was it, the Russians who didn't carry a one or something on a trip to Mars?
No, I think that was us.
Was that us?
I think so. I think it was an early NASA probe. I forget which one.
And then don't forget the Martian climate orbiter.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
Where one team used metric and the
other
used...
That's what it was. Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. Astronomy with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. More on the way. Shiny Stockings, just a great Frank Foster chart there, as done by Joe Pass. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. It's astronomy today, and it's Bob Berman, who really is he's a negative Nelly today. And also Valerie Rapson, who's trying not to get drawn into the black hole. But there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of skepticism here. Let's see if we can do something that'll raise Bob's spirits. We'll go to Rennie in Woodstock.
Hello there. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. Listen, I got a couple of questions quickly. I've been working on these mountainscapes artwork with constellations in them and the meteor that hit Panther Mountain. Do we know when the meteor hit Panther Mountain?
Where's Panther Mountain?
No, that's in the Catskills. Back when I still had my plane, I flew over it, and you can still see the crater shape very beautifully. It's not at the summit of the mountain, but it's not that far. It's not in the very bottom of the valley either. And I'm picturing it in my mind. So the caller, I can really relate to the caller. And no, I'm feeling great today, by the way,
I'm
Ray.
I'm kidding.
Bob, you flew me up to New Hampshire in that plane.
Did I really? Oh, that's so great. That's great.
So tell me more about this. Go ahead. Go ahead, Rennie.
Anyway, so I've been using, Ray mentioned it a couple days ago, the book Spirits and Stone that has stone cairns in the Catskills that are actual constellations. The 80-foot stone wall on Overlook is the constellation Draco. And I was wondering, I've been using Milky Way and Draco, but I've heard that the North Star used to be the Milky Way, and now is on the tip of Draco constellation.
Well, yes.
And how long ago did they change?
In about 2000 BC, the star Thuban in the constellation of Draco the Dragon was the North Star. And you can still...
That's not that long ago.
No, not really.
No, no. You know, the processional cycle being 25,780 years, so that means in a few thousand years, you're a good percentage of the way around that processional circle. So we went from Thuban to Kokob in the Little Dipper. That's the second brightest star in the Little Dipper. And now...
Right.
And that was the star that was closest to being the North Star in the time of Christ. And now, of course, it's moved to Polaris at the end of the Little Dipper's handle.
By the way, Rennie, Glenn Kreisberg, who wrote that book, Spirits and Stone, is going to be on this show July 23rd.
Oh, cool. And I don't know if I can mention it, but I'm having an art opening on May 6th at the Como property in the town offices with all my mountainscapes. And Glenn is going to come speak at that. He spoke last year.
Oh, tremendous.
And he'll go around and he'll talk about his book, but then he comes around to like all these different mountainscapes that I've made and comments on them.
Well, I don't know if you can mention it, but you just did. So that's fine. Yeah, it's good, man. Hey, good luck with that. Appreciate it. All right, Bob, tell me more about this meteor strike on, what was the mountain?
Panther.
Tell me about this. What do you know?
Boy, I wish I knew a lot more. Like when I think Rennie was asking when it happened, and maybe at one time I saw some data about it. I mean, right now it's so overgrown with trees and stuff that you know it wasn't anything in recent centuries. It was a long time ago, but if that sounds like I'm fudging,
no, it's fine.
It's because I don't know when.
How big is the strike, or how big is the crater?
Oh, I'd say the crater is a good several miles across.
Wow, yeah, really?
Very, very obvious.
So this probably did not happen within human history, either written or oral. So this, even the Native Americans wouldn't have seen this. This goes way back.
Yeah, I would think.
Incredible. All right, let's go. I did not know about that.
Me either.
Let's go to Larry in Niskayuna. Larry, you're on. Larry, you got to turn that radio down, buddy. Oh, it could take a while. So give him a few seconds. Zach, the engineer, shaking his head. All right, Larry, what do you think? Are you with us? You're gone. I'm so sorry. Let's go to Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Hello, hello. I appreciate that brief break while you were waiting for Larry. I was dizzy listening to the last caller and all of your answers.
Ah.
I was like, that fast? And then I got dizzy. My question is about what you just referenced, the smiley face in the morning earlier in your program.
Yeah.
Saturn, they made a point of saying it'll be very, very dim because it is matching the equal day and night equidium, I like to say at this time of year, with us, and then it'll be like 32,000 years before we match a solstice.
No,
can
no,
you
no.
give me like? I got it wrong. Okay, good.
Yes, it happens half of every Saturn cycle. Saturn takes 29.4577 years exactly to circle the sun.
Okay,
twice in that period. Its rings align towards the sun, which would be any planet's equinox. That's going to happen on May 6th. So it's going to be exactly sideways to the sun, and therefore neither hemisphere of Saturn lit up. But more important for us as observers, when you want to see Saturn without rings, and who does? Because the rings are the best
the
feature.
Point.
So wanting to see without rings is like saying, oh, you got to go to Niagara Falls. The water is missing. You know, you'd never say that. So, but if you did want to see Saturn without rings, and I've seen it four times in my life because I've been observing it over half a century. Then you need the time when the rings are edgewise to Earth. And that happened a few weeks ago. So when the rings are edgewise to Earth, because they're only a few hundred yards thick, they're very, very, very thin. Through even good telescopes, they can seem to vanish entirely.
The rings are only a few hundred yards.
Yes, yes.
This enormous planet.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
So they really seem to vanish, and that's what would be happening now. Unfortunately, because again, we said smiley face. So let's again mention for people just tuning in that all those things on the web showing Saturn and Venus above a smile-looking moon. That's not going to happen. Tomorrow morning, The moon is off to the left of the planets and a little below them, and the moon's on its side. So it's not the smile. It would be like your smile if you were lying in bed, maybe, and lying on your side. Huh. That kind of
thing. Okay. So it's like Cubist art in some ways.
But if you had it, if you had a good telescope and pointed it at Saturn, you might not see the rings because they are almost edgewise to Earth, and on May 6th, they're going to be exactly edgewise to the Sun. When the two of those coincide, then we really have no prayer of seeing even a straight line of light on Saturn.
So it looks much fainter than it should.
Yeah.
Joan, thanks a lot for the call. What I want to see, Valerie, is the hexagon at the pole.
Yeah.
Now, is that only visible in infrared? I mean, I've seen the pictures.
No, visible light.
It's visible.
You can see it?
Yeah, because it was the Cassini spacecraft that was doing the orbiting that took the picture. But, you know, Saturn is never really tilted with its north pole at us. So we have to be on the spacecraft to really get the best view to see it.
I think it's in the southern hemisphere, though, and Saturn's now we're going to start seeing the northern, unless I have it backwards in my mind.
No, you're probably right.
I think we had our best shot at that hexagon 8 years ago, 7 years ago. But it's still way up north.
So it's not like you can really easily see it from Earth.
Right.
It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551 if you have a question, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Now, Larry from Niskayuna had his radio on, and he didn't hear it when we went to him. So, Larry, before I click on, make sure your radio is off, and just talk amongst yourself for a moment. We'll give Larry 15 seconds.
I don't know what to say. You put us on the spot here.
All right, let's see if Larry's ready. Larry in Niskayuna, go ahead.
Okay, the question is about a place in Texas called Marfa.
Yeah, buddy.
And Marfa has these nighttime light phenomena. And I just wondered if any of you ever heard of it, because the only night that I was there, it rained, and you need a clear sky.
Yeah, we've heard of the Marfa. We've heard of that. This is more proof that me bringing that thing up before we went on the air had a result. Actually had a tangible result. Yeah, the Marfa lights are supposedly mysterious or ethereal or extraterrestrial or supernatural lights that shouldn't be there.
Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, it's an artsy community, so they kind of play up the whole space phenomena, but it's way too far south to be the aurora borealis, but not far south enough to be the aurora australis, right? It's in Texas.
Right, plus the aurora doesn't show up as discrete points of light, like star-like points of light.
Yeah, no, I don't know if it's like the green wave of you know, sort of undulating light in the sky, but people there they go outside of town, and the town it voluntarily does this thing called dark skies. So there's very little street light, there's very little artificial light, so as to enhance nighttime viewing of stars. Which it sounds nice, but you can't see it unless you happen to go outside of town on a clear night. And it rained the one night I was there with my brothers on like a road trip to Big Bend. There's a lot of empty space out in Texas. I don't know if you ever heard that.
Yeah. Larry, did you ever do a search to see whether there's been an investigation on that? Because one thing that I read some years ago, a skeptical report, was that it was just car headlights reflecting off different things.
And that has been discussed and is a possibility. Yeah. And there have been a number of scientific or quasi-scientific discussions about this. And there's one similar analogous case which has been going on for decades in Norway. You should check it out. I forget the name of the lights.
Okay.
But this is something that is very famous over there. And it's very similar to what they're reporting in Marfa. Yeah, so check it out. I appreciate it very much. I believe some of the UFO groups in the 70s have been... This has been investigated, the Marfa lights, for some time, and I think the theory that they're car lights is one that is still strong. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, who knows? Nobody knows. The number here is 800-348-2551. Oh, let's go to Chris in Housatonic. Chris, you're on.
Yeah, Valerie, I got a question for you, a couple of questions. A couple of nights ago, I was in the post office, and I heard a clap of thunder, but I didn't see any of the lightning. And then the second question I have is, there's another Bermuda Triangle in the Great Lakes as well as Alaska.
Huh. Amazing.
Is that uncommon?
These are not really fair for an astronomy show, but go ahead, Valerie.
Well, I mean, I'm not a meteorologist. So I'm not going to be great at explaining thunder and lightning, but we often see, you know, storms with thunder without lightning. But the Bermuda Triangle stuff, you know, that's been investigated. We're pretty sure it's not aliens, you know, going back to that kind of stuff. But it's,
you know. Do you think Atlantis is still down there?
Atlantis. Oh, gosh. That's another show.
I mean, who knows?
Bob, you want to weigh in?
If we keep melting these ice caps, we're all going to be in Atlantis.
Atlantis at least has a little bit of basis for it because the Great Santorin volcano explosion that really wiped out that island of Santorini, which was called what? Thera back in the old days? Supposedly created such destruction that it destroyed the Minoan civilization on nearby Crete. And there's some speculation that this may have, because it was about, if I remember right, about 1600 BC, it was at the right time and the right part of the world to have given rise to the mythology of a destroyed civilization in that part of the world. And that may have been the origin of the Atlantis myth.
Okay.
One more question.
Okay.
Do you think aliens abducted Flight 19?
Flight 19. Well, I think this is not for the astronomers to weigh in on. But my question for you, Chris, is what were you doing in the post office at night?
I was just getting my mail and reading it, and all of a sudden I heard the thunder, right? But maybe I said to myself, could there be black lightning?
Oh, black lightning. Mm. Well, I know I've seen black lights, but not black lightning. Hey, thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Billy in Roxbury. Billy, you're on.
Hey, Ray. I was hiking up Panther Mountain, and when I got to the top, I took out my Boy Scout compass, and it didn't point north. It just kind of spun around randomly. Could that be a result of the meteorite hitting it?
That's fascinating. It really could have been because if it was a nickel iron meteorite, called an octahedrite, by the way, if it was that type, then very often you do get nickel iron underground. I mean, I believe there's quite a bit in Barringer, Arizona, the famous meteor crater that was formed 50,000 years ago in Arizona. A fascinating place. Everyone should visit it if you haven't already. That sounds plausible.
Interesting. And has anybody done any academic research into this?
I don't know. It's fascinating.
We'll have to look it up for the next show.
There's a USG marker at the summit that clearly indicates true north, but my compass didn't line up with it at all.
I wonder if you had brought a gravity detector, if you would have found a difference, or if it would, I don't know if you have to do those things from the air, but you know, there are spots where gravity there are little variations in gravity, and from what I understand, it's from deposits in the ground.
Sure.
So would a reasonable size meteor affect gravity, you know, if it hits the ground, a meteorite.
You'd have to have a really precise detector, I would imagine.
Right.
I
wonder if the caller noticed a circular shaped rock or metal that started unscrewing itself when you were there at Panther Mountain.
What do you mean, Bob?
Well, that's in the War of the Worlds.
I see.
Okay.
Are you making sport of Billy? Roxbury.
No, I think Billy's question was legit.
Yeah, I think so too. That's so cool. Hey, Billy.
Listen,
go ahead, man.
I'm into it, man. I have those stone cairns near my house here, and it's
okay.
They line up with the north. And when I first moved here, Comet Hale-Bopp appeared.
Yeah, yes.
And
that's cool.
House got hit by a ball lightning. I was like,
wow.
All kinds of weird phenomenon in the Catskills.
So cool. Well, you know, again, that show will be July 23rd. I hope you call in then, and we'll talk about your standing stones on your property. appreciate it. I guess we're about done here. Valerie, if people want to find out more about the planetarium and such over at SUNY Oneonta, how do they do that?
Yeah, search SUNY Oneonta Planetarium. We're going to have shows all summer long, including a show related to Minecraft. So for all the kids listening, yes, there is a short show. So we'll have that all summer on Saturdays.
Very cool. Bob, if people want to find out about your tours and whatnot, how do they do that?
Simplest would be just Bob Berman Tours. Sounds like it's my company, which it isn't, but that link will immediately go and give you information.
So you're just the talent, as it were.
So to speak, okay. Yes. But the Atacama Desert, that's worth going to.
Okay, now where's that? Chile?
Yeah, that'll be in November.
All right, that's exciting. Well, thank you both for being here. Support comes from Woodland Pond at New Paltz, a life plan community at the foot of the Schwungunks, near education, the arts, and outdoor activities. Future residency wait list available, woodlandpondnp.org. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the forests, wetlands, shorelines, and ridges that protect Lake George permanently. Projects, events, and news at lglc.org. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Food Friday, and we'll learn about the taste of Rhinebeck with Chef Josh Kroner and some others. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.